Welcome to this episode of the Level Design Podcast. I am Mark Drew, and I welcome you to another delicious dive down the dark alleys and corridors of level design and games. In this episode, we have managed to get that creme de la creme of developers to come and answer your questions and give us their thoughts on level design. If you have a question, you can send it to show@leveldesign.fm or tweet or direct message me on Twitter. I am at Mark Drew. With me today is Jonathan Wilson of Pocket Money. Wait a minute, I'm not falling for this. You're not at Pocket Money Games anymore, are you, Jonathan?
I'm not anymore, no. On Monday of this week, so as of recording the 20th of May, I joined Hangar 13 as a level designer. Yeah, down here in Brighton.
Congratulations, John.
Thank you.
So is the Brighton crew here?
Brighton's growing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because that voice you can hear in the background is, in fact, Rob McLachlan, who was on the episode one at our EGX panel from the Chinese Room, also based in Brighton, correct?
Yes, that's right. Hello, everyone. It's really good to be here for the first recorded episode.
Hopefully this is going to be a bit better than episode one, because I knew there were a few cutouts in the audio that they gave us and I had no control over all of that. It's not the big censorship machine kind of...
But you have all the control now, Mark. You have all the control.
Yeah, I have all the control. I can do all the cutting. I can make us sound really intelligent, which is much better than doing it live. Before we get on to the questions, because from the panel, we had a whole bunch of questions, more than we could have answered in those few minutes. So hence these series of podcasts. What was your experience of the panel, Rob?
It was a really worthwhile experience. It was really good to see so many people there. I think we were I wouldn't want to brag, but I think we were the best attended panel at the show. The room was full to overflowing, and it was extremely interesting answering everyone's questions and just a really good rapport with the crowd, I thought.
Yeah, it was really, I think that system that we used, which has derived a lot of the questions that we still answer, was really good because it's managed to keep the thoughts alive, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It was really interesting seeing people voting for the questions and us choosing based on that. Oh, that was a really fantastic plan. Got the whole audience interested in what everyone was going
to
say.
Good way to get the audience engaged, and definitely a system we can keep plugging. Like, you can put that link out over Twitter, and if people want questions for the podcast, it's an easy way to curate them.
Yeah, I think this is very good for a live kind of event, because, you have to pay for the longer level event. So the system that we're talking about, obviously, is called Slido, SLI.DO, which is a really good system for these kind of like live questions, because then you don't have people like putting their arms up and shouting over each other like kids in a school, right?
And people don't always feel comfortable doing that in a crowd either. They'll like, I've given talks in the past where,
right,
it's like, okay, any questions, and you expect them to raise their hand and they'll not ask anything. But when everyone leaves, they'll come and see you at the podium or at the front or whatever and ask you like individually. But if they have a different medium to give you that question, like we did during the panel, you're more likely to get more questions done.
And you get less of those, less of a question, more of a statement.
Yes, yeah.
The curse of the conference talk. Yeah, I think some of the people who come up at the end of these talks are actually, they have some of the most interesting questions. So it's good to, the people who don't want to stand up and speak out, they can hide in their inner nerd and just answer their questions via an app.
Yeah.
It's probably the best thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, in other words, it's a nicer way of doing it. So if you need to, they're not sponsoring the show at all, but this is kind of been a really good one. It was actually Tommy Thompson from AI in Games that actually put me onto it. So next topic is, if you also want to get in contact with us, dear listener, you can actually follow us on Twitter. Finally, Twitter handle is @leveldesignfm. And oh boy, did that take some doing.
That was a bit of a journey and a half to get that up and running.
Yeah, that was... you might think that creating a new account on Twitter is very, very easy. A billion Russian spam bots seem to be able to do it every day quite well. But this one grown adult person, that is I, decided to put the birth date of the podcast to the date of the EGX panel. So as far as Twitter was concerned, a one-month-old podcast had been created. But so they restricted me, saying that no, people under 13 could not post.
No Twitter accounts for people under 13. It's not allowed, apparently.
Kind of people of that tender age signing up, yeah, to see all the hottest memes and biggest alt-right edgelords.
It's a minefield out there.
Yeah.
It's like too many memes. It would blow the minds.
Yeah, too much, too much. But anyway, so if you want to follow us, we're at Level Design FM. But without much ado, let's dive into the questions. We answered a lot of these questions. If we've answered them in the previous podcast because we have terrible memory, I'm going to ask Rob the questions anyway because he hasn't answered them. And one of the questions that I think has come up a little bit, but I wanted to ask you about this, is how much do you think level design informs like the core mechanics versus the other way around, the core mechanics informing level design? Or is it just a one-way street?
That's really interesting. So it all comes down to, I think, the setting of the game. Now, level design is such a huge environment to think about something like the level design of a puzzle game as well as the level design of some sort of massive open mm-hmm. world MMORPG. So I feel like the level design is so crucially connected to the setting and story and narrative of the game that really I would say that is effectively the mechanics of the game that inform the level design the most. Mm. But it's such a kind of feedback loop that you get. Everything goes round and reinforces itself continually.
Yeah, I think a good example of that, and I was playing this not so long, the other night, in fact, is like What Remains of Edith Finch. There was a lot of very specific mechanics that were like very, like one-offs, you know, like how you open some doors and you never use it again.
And I think that's definitely more common in, like you said, like narrative games like What Remains of Edith Finch versus a platformer or an action game, which is cover shooter, where you will get a lot of reusable mechanics because it's just that's going to inform the game player. And then it becomes more about chaining them together. So I think like Rob said, it definitely depends on the setting of the game and largely the type of the game as well.
So for example, I'm thinking Gears of War, right? That's got like certain cover mechanic, it's got a grenade mechanic, and you just ramp up the enemies, but your level design is kind of dictated by quantity of enemies that you want to have there.
Those core mechanics,
exactly.
It is, and also by the setting on the sort of abandoned alien world where enemies come out from under the ground. So you have level design that is afforded the gameplay that reinforces that story, really. So you have cover shooting based on moving around ruins, and moving around fragments of buildings. And then when you generally enter an arena, and generally enemies will appear from under the ground, and you'll have a series of encounters that are based around that ruined building, and you'll move from encounter to encounter like that. It's a very interesting level design that Gears of War has because it is so focused on the kind of tightly controlled experiences, really.
I have an admission to make, Rob. I was trying to get, before this podcast, a copy of Silent Hill Shattered Memories.
Oh, were you really?
Yeah.
Have I got one in here? I think I've actually got a Wii version. Well, a Wii is definitely the definitive version, exactly. The definitive version of Silent Hill Shattered Memories, because the motion controls are actually really good. We use the Wiimote to do the phone and the traditional Silent Hill radio effect.
Oh,
so you've got that coming out the Wiimote.
Yeah, that would work really well.
Yeah, so because the Wii, you know, is effectively two GameCubes duct taped together,
yes.
It's got reasonable graphical heft. So it looked pretty good on that as well. So yeah, I would definitely encourage you to find one of the 500 copies of Wii Silent Hill Shattered Memories that Konami printed and give it a go.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's a good advice. And a Wii, of
course. Sounds like a treasure hunt.
Find one. Yeah, find a Wii that the batteries haven't leaked and destroyed it.
This was a question I think came up last episode, which is how does level design determine the length, like the playable length of a game?
We talked about game length a little bit before, but when it comes down to the level design, once again, Rob mentioned, it's definitely a type thing. It's like if it's a choreographed game, like a narrative experience, like What Remains of Edith Finch, you're probably going to know, okay, this walk should take 3 minutes. Like it should take X amount of minutes to find this interaction point. And that's a heavily choreographed like kind of game. But if you go into open world games where it can't be a super choreographed experience because you're in a sandbox. So if I've got to drive to my objective, or if I've got to to go and meet someone and pick them up. There's probably a million different ways I could actually go there. But it's like that street that you've got to be on to actually continue the next story beat would be there. But it could take me, if I go directly and mainline it, could take five minutes. But if you drive around and go around all the back streets and explore, it could take 15 to 20. So once again, based on the game, yeah, it's going to like elongate your length. And open world games, like especially when you're thinking about level design and wanting to get the player to go from A to B, you can only come up with a critical path, and that critical path will be, you know, the length of that, but the length it could take the player to go around in an open world game could be almost double to three times that.
I was playing a game, I won't mention it at the moment, and I found it interesting that how the design of the level, not so much the level design, and what you put in it, actually had to tie in very much in with a narrative, because sometimes there are triggered events or voices that happen, let's say that a narration kicks off. And as the player, won't just stand there listening to it, right? They'll start walking, and you want to put very little interaction in the way because you want them to listen to that, you know?
Yeah,
which is a challenge, absolutely. If you're creating a game which has, for example, some sort of voiceover, for example, take Soma as an example, where you have quite a lot of voice acting that is taking place with the people off screen. Either you've picked up audio logs, the level designer's friend, or you are getting radio transmissions or so on, or you're getting some sort of recording, System Shock 2 style of some kind of a far-off overseer who you're not quite sure if you trust or not. And at that point, it's, you know, are you going to start putting little fiddly things for the player to do in that area, or are you just going to have them walking through effectively a blank tunnel and hoping that they are getting enough out of just the voiceover to forgive the fact that there's not much else to do? Because I guess you don't really want to distract the player and split their attention.
I definitely think there's a fine balance to be found in scenarios like that. Because with audio logs, like you say, they are great for like telling wider stories or building on characters that exist in the world, but you might never actually interact with them. It gives you that side plot you can develop. Because I remember in, like, I think it was Dishonored 2, you had like the actual audio logs would be positional. So if you walked away from them, you wouldn't be able to hear it. So like you had to stay in the area. But I think one of the things it suffered from, like other than maybe raking around in a couple of drawers, there wasn't a great deal to do, which it was a step in the right direction, I think, for finding the right balance of keeping the player there. It was just putting a few things to pick up around the audio log. But once again, you were usually done and probably moving on unless the audio was enough to captivate you kind of in that environment.
Yeah, picking up that apple or those little coins, that was like enough time for you to listen to the audio log and not feel like you're just standing there like a mullock waiting for... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or you could put a beautiful view out of the window so they can have a look at that, or, you know, some sort of sci-fi hallway where you can look out and see a spaceship landing or something like that you go, wow, that's something I can look at for a bit.
Yeah, I think that's a good point as well. Taking advantage of your environment is definitely a very easy way to captivate the player. So, like, if you've said, like you said, Rob, if it was a sci-fi game, you can have ships landing, or you can have, like, cars flying past and sirens outside, or it is this beautiful vista, like, overlooking something. But, yeah, it's like that's sometimes enough to anchor the player in place. But as level designers and kind of game developers, it's like we have a lot of stuff to play with to try and hold the player's attention, like in that time frame, that environment. But you've definitely got to bring all components together to actually pull that off. Like, it isn't just, so the level designer needs to make sure you enter the room and you trigger the interaction looking this way, so you see the vista or you see whatever special event is going to bring in and actually interrupt the player's view.
Yeah, that's a really interesting decision to have to make, to kind of take control of the player, what the player's looking at, and show them something. It's really interesting how they do it in the new Wolfenstein games. Mm-hmm. It's obviously the big budget way of doing an audio log is to have a fully acted sequence of wonderfully rendered enemies or antagonists or friends who are all talking to you. And, you know, you can either have the player have full control during that sequence or even hold their head in a certain way. I think we've kind of moved beyond, as an industry, that kind of thing of completely taking control of the player camera.
I don't think today you can do that anymore. Like, it just breaks players' expectations too much now. Like, a while ago we got away with it with cutscenes, for instance, but that was like, we can still use cutscenes today because they are a very different perspective. Like, the camera will change and it is usually for this really cinematic moment, but it doesn't work in the instance of just, like you say, an audio log or an interaction anymore, because it breaks up the player. And as soon as you take control away from the player, you've probably just brought them out of that experience. And once you've done that, you've almost lost them. And that's the hard thing to try and to contend with.
The other thing that Wolfenstein is very interesting for is their home bases. So in the first one, I completely forget there. Is it the New Colossus or the other one? I can't remember. Or the New Order. Which came first? I can't remember now. Okay, so there's the first one is in the kind of the basement of the sort of
the New Order
apartment, I think.
Yes, the New Order was the first one. The New Order was the first one.
Okay, so that's the first one. So you can wander around there and you can kind of experience different stories. So you can go to the sort of Jimi Hendrix kind of character and take some drugs and go on a crazy hallucinogenic trip. Or you can just go and talk to the obvious love interest that's been provided to you and talk to them. Or you can go and sort out little quests and stuff.
Yeah.
And in the second game, you have the whole U-boat, this big, huge sort of nuclear-powered Nazi submarine that you can wander around. And that has a even more elaborate ecosystem of people that you can go and talk to. And it's kind of up to the player to an extent how long they stay there and look at everything and find all the little pieces of paper to read and talk to people who are not really of any interest in the story before they do the
next story beat.
Exactly. Start following the hive and go for, you know, the gate that's going to take them to the next part of the story.
And I think if you get a game where players will do that and they invest time like exploring the world, then that's testament to the world you've built. You've built an engaging and interesting world they want to explore and want to learn more. Two examples I can kind of think of are the DSX games, Human Revolution and Mankind Divided. Like, well, they might not have been like perfect or solid from like a complete game design point of view, but their worlds were very realized. Like, they were fully realized. Like, I remember spending time just going breaking into people's windows because now I could jump higher and I could now read this person's emails and stuff. But it was just because you wanted to know more about like the corporate espionage that you knew was going on in the world, but you, by exploring, you found out how deep it went. But you'd not find out so many things if you didn't actually do half of that stuff.
That's really true. And it's a way of, yeah, creating a world of especially the NPCs, to sort of give them some sort of backstory. Dishonored does this as well, doesn't it? Where you can listen to people's thoughts and, you know, you can then kind of say, well, actually, I hate this person, so I'm going to do something terrible to them. I'm going to push them off a building or something because they murdered their child or something.
It helps you justify killing them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Because otherwise, just killing them, just outright killing them, is just not a done thing. Because
yeah, it's okay. It's okay if you're 14 years old, but I think we've
no, done that now. That's it.
We do it for real reasons now. We actually kill people for real reasons. That's fine.
By the way, that was the first one was the New Order. Then it was the old blood.
Yes, and, exactly.
And the New Colossus.
Is that the DLC or is that the next one?
The DLC. The old blood was a DLC. And now is Wolfenstein, and then is Youngblood, which is the one that's coming out.
Oh yes, the new one. That looks really interesting. Really looking forward to that.
With the twins.
I love the new Wolfenstein games. They're really cracking experiences. They have a lot of old school ways of doing things, but just done in a really fantastic way, and just give you a hell of a lot of great shooting content.
Yeah,
I think it was a refreshing, it was nice, like when Wolfenstein came out, it was like a refreshing first person shooter. It like wasn't going down the whole like sci-fi route, it wasn't going like that, and it gave you, like you said, it does things in very interesting ways, and even the themes the game deals with itself are dealt with in a unique way over how you would find them done in a typical like old school Medal of Honor or Battlefield or something like that.
Yeah. I totally agree. Yeah, it has a real sort of personal character arc, whereas we tend to find with the sort of modern warfare genre that you have a much more expansive story where you're taking on multiple roles, which gives you a better overview of the entire conflict and so on for the game. But certainly that Wolfenstein is all about a kind of personal war, I think.
I mean, does start, I mean, I don't want this to become the Wolfenstein podcast, but it does start with, hey, I'm not against it, but it does start with B.J. Blazkowicz sort of in hospital, right? And it doesn't start immediately with that, but it's kind of like time has passed. You are now old because you've been in this, you know, in this German overrun hospital, and you go all the way that to not redeem yourself, but come back, you know. Sorry, spoilers.
Yeah. Yeah, but what is it? What is it with these old game designers making all their characters up?
Yeah.
You see it in the new God of War as well. Suddenly, all the game directors have grown up and got kids, and now, oh, here's Kratos. He's grown up and got kids.
Yeah,
it's kind of like write what you know, but also people looking back at their careers and the types of game they have made, and the amount of time they spent doing it, they go, oh, hang on. Now, I'm always of the opinion that making games is pretty great. It's not working down a mine.
Mm.
My wife's grandfather worked down a mine and broke his back 3 times and died of constructive COPD.
Oh.
You know, a horrendous life. And I'm not, you know, overtime in the games industry is just absolutely dreadful. And I condemn it and I will never do it. But I think these game directors have spent a lot of time working on games, not seeing their family, and they're going, oh crap, actually maybe there's something that I should be looking after, so
something else I should be doing.
Exactly. You get a beautiful game like God of War, and I highly recommend everyone to watch the documentary on the making of Raising Kratos. It's absolutely amazing. Yeah,
I've been saving it because I ashamedly haven't played God of War yet.
I haven't played through it yet either, and there's not many spoilers. So I've not completely finished it. So
that's okay. Actually, when I think back to it now, watching it, you're right. There's not many spoilers, but yeah, just watching the development cycle of that game, like how it came from its inception of what it was, like the turmoil, like Corey Barlog went through trying to basically get it greenlit and picked up by the studio, and then finding out, like I think in the documentary they see the game they wait Santa Monica was working on, that had like 36 months of pre-production. What? And that basically got canned in place of doing God of War.
Yeah, it's,
you don't see much about the canned game, but like you see at least the start of it before God of War enters full production.
Yeah, I was lucky or unlucky enough, well no, actually totally unlucky enough to completely miss as a generation any release games on PS3 or Xbox 360 simply because all the games I worked on got cancelled.
Oh,
which is, you know, it's kind of what happens.
Yeah. And it's the industry. Yeah,
exactly. Same for this Sony Santa Monica. You know, imagine those people working 3 years on something that I'm sure they believed in and having that cancelled. It can be quite brutal.
I think it's an interesting thing to think about, I guess, the production side of games as well, because a part of the documentary, like the God of War team is very small. And because of that cancellation, they ended up with like 100-odd employees ready to work, but they weren't ready for them. They weren't far enough along in the development.
Mm.
So it's a very interesting documentary just to kind of, I guess, see how the life cycle of a AAA game can go, and like its ups and downs and what it actually goes through to get there.
Absolutely. It kind of made me feel a bit better as well, seeing Shuhei Yoshida coming to their studio and just standing there stony-faced and looking at their game and hating it. Because I think a lot of people will have been through that who work in the games industry, where your game, you look at your game, you think it is terrible, and objectively, because you're probably an experienced game designer, you go, objectively, I know this game is terrible.
Yeah.
And I, you know, how can I make it better? And sometimes it doesn't seem like it will ever come better. But as we've seen with God of War, often it does.
I think it's the case when you're working on it, though, you eventually do get too close. You need like an outsider to give you that kind of feedback, and like it gives you time to step back as well. And it's like we all, like I think on some degree we all like to try and be perfectionists, but we need to understand how it works. Like time is always going to be our enemy.
Time and budgets is always the enemy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And this takes us back to something I thought of when we were to an earlier point in this conversation, where we were talking about how the time that you get in a game, how the length of the game is dependent on the level design. Because it's interesting to me that I was just thinking, in some of the games I've worked on, we've mapped out the high level story. And then we've said, how do we get these characters from here to there? And then we go, wouldn't it be cool if they went to here? Wouldn't it be cool if it went to here, went to here, went to here?
So you start plugging the gaps.
Exactly. You start plugging the gaps. And I'm sure this, you know, you get this episode or chapter or world or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, okay, this is this chapter. And then you sort of cut that off from the rest of the gameplay. And you then sort of say, well, we're going to have like 10 chapters. And you sort of split them up. And then suddenly you've got a game which is a certain length. And sometimes you make all this stuff and you go, holy cow, we've made a game way too long.
Yeah.
Or holy cow, we made a game that's way too short.
Yeah.
Or holy cow, we've made a game where chapters 4 and 5 are absolutely fantastic and chapter 6 is just the dreariest, dreary thing because we've stretched out a really small amount of gameplay and story over a huge thing.
I think you will always have that high level thing, right? Like, so you'll always have your, ideally, potentially your story arc for you to then go, right, you said, Rob, we need to go from point A to point B, and that adventure that happens in between, it can be, okay, you know your characters, you know everything like that, so it's okay, have they met? Yes, no, okay, we need to cover that. That can be a couple of levels. Okay, does there need to be a group of people at a set point to pull off a certain mission? So you know you can kind of truncate it down. And the only problem is, with that approach, sometimes that's when you end up with the game being way beyond the length you ever intended the game to be.
Absolutely.
So I think the question was aimed in one way, but which was, you know, like when you say on the box, this is a 60-hour game, It's really difficult because I've stood in game conventions and like some people blast through some games, some people like, you know, pick apart everything. I mean, depends what the game is. If it's a Wipeout type game, you know, it's 1:33.6, right?
Yeah. So when I think when developers talk about game length, or at least come out and say, okay, this is going to be a 60-plus-hour experience, that's usually based off like user testing and the internal kind of QA they've done. So they'll have like, you'll have your main story. So obviously some people will blast through that, but they'll always try to account for some of that side stuff as well. So going off the beaten path a little bit and exploring. But to get the exact estimate, like you say, because every player is going to be different, it's almost like impossible to go, this is going to be exactly 20 hours. Like, you're never going to go over that 20-hour mark. But yeah, like you said, some, like, you watch people at conventions, they blast through a level, they pick it up, they don't care about the actual exploring and picking up any of the side stuff. They just want to go through, get the story. So they'll probably do it in like maybe 6 hours. Whereas someone who explores a little bit, that could escalate, add another 3 hours of gameplay for them because they're doing side quests and everything like that. So now you've got a 10-hour experience. But yeah, it's definitely good. It requires a lot of testing once your game is playable from start to end. And that's can be quite challenging to get to that point anyway. But that's when you can start making those estimates. Like, once you've got a build that you can go from mission 1 to mission whatever, that you can start gauging now how long is this game.
Yeah. And I don't think that should be a too much of a value call for it. But this leads on to the next question, which is, you know, the speedrunning events. This is by another anonymous poster, by the way. I haven't said the names of people who've been posting so far because a lot of them are anonymous. But has speedrunning events showcased, like on Twitch TV, such as a European Speedrunner Assembly and Games Done Quick, changed the way you level design newer games, or you look at the level design in newer games?
Yes, I think it has, because I think it's become more high profile.
Right.
I love watching some of these videos and seeing the tactics people use to speedrun games. And also because games nowadays, as we've seen, that the professional, supposedly corrupt game reviewer has now been replaced by the incorruptible streamer who gets paid $50,000 for an hour of their time to show the game.
I wish people got paid that much.
It all depends on your audience.
Yeah, that's true. Like, I don't think I've got a very good audience.
Just get another 20 million subscribers and you'll be rolling, obviously. But yeah, so what I love to do in games is to provide a sort of shortcuts, not the kind of lame shortcuts where if you, you know, press the third stone down on the wall in these 5 rooms, it opens up a secret passage that takes you to another level, but more to give the player the opportunity to play the game how they want to play, because that is what people love to do nowadays. And certainly my indie game Winterhall, the people got most upset when I was forcing them to play at a pace that they were not comfortable with. So I had the player following a young girl who leads them through this kind of plague-stricken village, and I made the cardinal sin of making her movement speed faster than the player's walk speed, but slower than the player's run speed.
So it was always like trying to
deeply
just...
It's impossible to keep up with her, or you just keep overtaking her. And if you overtake her too much, she stops and says, "Oh, why can't you? Why are you running off? Or, yeah, come with me quickly, mistress." And so I will deeply apologise for that. I was standing there with my head in my hands at the show, watching people play this. But certainly, yeah. So making sure that the systems in your game aren't broken by players playing in an individual way, I think it's a good habit to get into, because it obviously reduces the number of edge case bugs that you have as well, because it makes you think about the logic in your level and going, well, actually, I'm not just going to say 2 seconds after, I'm not going to put in horrible delays in my level script flow, so I don't say 2 seconds after triggering this trigger, I'm going to trigger this trigger, because that's just asking for trouble when the player takes 1.5 seconds to get to the trigger and then go to the trigger and then the trigger doesn't work and then they can't go further and it all breaks and you go, oh my God, how did you do that? So yeah, making sure your level script is robust is really a good
plan. Rob's definitely right. Like trying to be robust, putting forced or set like hard-coded delays, it's too much of a risk now because let's say players want to play how they play and if they are speedrunning your level, they're going to knock all of your hard-coded delays out of sync, like, immediately. And they're just going to stand there and be getting VO they should have got, like, I don't know, like, 20 minutes ago. And it's going to come off as, like, this person's talking about something I went past already, and I now don't know what I'm doing.
But, Jonathan, elevators. We have to have those elevator scenes.
Yes. Lock them in elevators. It's fine.
Yeah.
Lock them in elevators while you desperately try to load the next bit of the level, yeah.
Yes.
This actually leads on, talking about Winter Hall. Did you see, Rob, did you see a game that came out recently called A Plague Tale?
Yes, I did. It looks really interesting. I really loved some of the things I've heard about it. I've not played it, but one of the things I noticed in a review was the fact that the little boy you play, you're kind of your companion. At some point, he gives you a flower. And you can put it in your hair. And then for the rest of the game, you have that flower in your hair. I thought that was a lovely little touch. And yeah, I'm looking forward to giving it a go when I can dig myself out from under this mountain of unfinished games that I have.
You're not the only one there. It's fine. It's like we're all there with you.
We've all got it. We're all single-handedly supporting the UK games and the world games industry by buying.
Yeah. So say I have this pile of started stuff and I'm like, oh, there's something shiny over there. I want this new thing as well.
I've decided to, despite me famously hating Corridor's finish, Echo by the Ultra Ultra.
Okay.
Which is a beautiful game. And it's each time I play it, I just sit there going, like, how did they make this so, these environments so gorgeous? It's a thing that, like, I have a moment, just have to have a moment. I'm watching it, but I have to have a moment to just
take it all in,
look around it. It's like kind of Louis XIV kind of palace that you're in, but it's huge. It's like a massive and a super detail. A lot of repeated assets and things like that. So I kind of know the trick. But the sadness is that the Ultra Ultra recently announced that they're disbanding as a company, which is kind of like, no, this is an awesome game.
Yeah, it's really sad to hear that. Yeah, because it was amazing looking and a really groundbreaking
game.
It's
definitely one of like this industry the way it is. It is always sad to hear about like studios fall out or like studios breaking down, despite it is how some studios started, right? That's kind of like how we got the indie boom as well. It was like the collapse or fall of like bigger studios, but like because so people are in our industry, they're so passionate about making games, it doesn't matter whether you change job, you move on or whatever, something usually you still end up doing something in games, whether it's your own thing or it's setting up a studio with other people.
I mean, I guess it's this. I think it's maybe a disconnect between a product, which is the game, that then you're trying to make a company out of.
Yeah.
Just on the sales of that game, you know.
Sometimes you don't even know that's going to happen.
No.
You create a company to make a game, and in many cases, well, in that rare event where the game just absolutely takes off and goes stratospheric, sometimes you can be stuck in something you weren't really expecting to be doing, and you can end up with a load of problems that you never knew even existed and that you're not quite sure how to sort, like suddenly going from 3 employees to 30 and trying to make that all work. Even in a very, very slow industry, that's tough, but in mainly making a game, and the modern way of making games is to be very responsive to your audience and always have updates and things. It's an incredibly difficult way to work.
So, expansion seems to happen a lot quicker as well within games. At least like I've noticed that in like, kind of like my time of working in the industry, it's like whether even if you start out as a few people early on doing this one project, as soon as another project comes in or something, you immediately need more people because your ideas, your ambition changes, the scope of your projects are getting bigger, which naturally requires more resources. And then, yeah, you just watch it balloon. But yeah, I don't think I've seen companies in other industries ever grow as fast as what I've seen companies within games. Granted, it does depend on the opportunities that come your way, but it's like I do see a lot of companies start to balloon fairly quickly in games.
Yeah, which is good news, really, for people who are coming into the games industry.
Yes.
I know there's that horrendous chicken the egg thing of job adverts saying experienced staff wanted when, you know, you've just entered the thing. But certainly from any my recent hirings in the last 10 years, I am still looking at graduates and people who have worked on projects in their spare time in Unity or Unreal and have created some really fascinating things. I think that's a perfectly valid way to gain experience. And I would always encourage people to continue working on this stuff. And the jobs are there. There's massive demand in the UK games industry alone for people to work in games.
I feel people need to, like in some cases, like you said, working on games in your own time is enough to learn about the tools, learn about the process of developing a game and things like that and putting it out there. But they need to, I think people or students, for instance, don't understand that that is valid experience. And like they believe, oh, it says I need X amount of experience because like with a company. It's like, yes, but you've got this in your portfolio, you've done this, like still apply. But because it's in writing on that job description, 3+ years experience, it turns a lot of people away. And I've spoke to like countless students, I've spoke to friends who've like got about a year or so in the industry that won't apply to certain jobs because of that description still. And I kind of feel there needs to be a shift in the way we look at it, or there needs to be a shift in what we categorize as experience and make like especially students or people applying for jobs aware of what is being classed as experience.
Yeah, that's very true. And without wanting to flood the inboxes of every single Combs company recruiter in the land, I would say, you know, if you see a company hiring, you know, it's if you don't think that the job is quite right for the level of experience you have, but you feel like you could do the job, then you should apply. And I would say this definitely goes. This is a point I've made at previous careers talks at EGX and elsewhere, especially if you are a female games developer. It is scientifically proven that female applicants to jobs are less likely to apply to jobs that they feel are beyond them than men, because men are idiots who don't know when to stop. So I would say, you know, do apply to these jobs, because you never know, you might not fit that job, but with these modern recruitment systems, your name will stay on file.
Yeah.
And you may well be picked up very shortly afterwards.
I think it's just important to, like we said, to remember, read that job description. If you feel you can do the majority of those roles and this sounds like a job that you can do or something you've done in a project in the past, just apply. Don't worry about the number. Like, don't worry about that number of years experience necessarily. I'm not saying apply for a lead role straight out of university here, but it's just like, if you're applying for a general design role or program role or artist role, like, try not to get hung up on that amount of years experience requires. It's always going to be there. I don't think it'll ever go away from the job description.
So sorry to interrupt, but one of the things that I take away, not being put in the industry specifically, but put it this way, kids, sit down, play any game and look at how many assets are built into it. Look at how many environmental assets are, how many audio logs there are, how many whatevers they are. There are thousands of bits that go into a game.
Yep.
Sometimes I'm astonished by the amount of stuff that's in it that you go, you didn't even need to do that, right? The placing of the plants in like Resident Evil Bioshock, right? Like there's a whole bloody forest before you get to the main bit. Who do you think makes that?
Yeah.
Right?
Mm.
It might not be the best job, but if you're straight out of university, you're not going to become a lead level designer, but they still need people that are qualified, that have got an eye, that maybe you haven't had 40,000 hours placing trees, but hey, they can teach you that.
Yeah.
Maybe not an example. I'm not making it sound sexy that you're placing trees, but...
But you're right, Mark.
So you're completely right. The modern asset pipelines of creating things are becoming extremely difficult to fill the number of people you need to create these assets. You know, it takes much longer to build things because they have to be done to a higher quality level. Exactly. You know, you have to create a massive amount of highly detailed texture maps, and you have to sculpt very high detail models and bake them down. It takes a lot of people. And if you can come out of university, you may find yourself actually working faster and be more familiar with newer tools than even people who have been at companies for a long time, simply because there are a lot of companies out there who were using proprietary tools for a very long time. And you may find that you suddenly go keep an eye out for a job advert that says, oh, we suddenly need Unreal people, we suddenly need Unity people. You may find if you join that company that you actually know more about Unreal or Unity than people who have been there 10 years, simply because they've been using some proprietary tech with some crazy name that they've just decided to throw away because they can't keep up with Epic or Unity.
But for those level designers out there, I mean, I know the graduates and us non-industry people, are there any books that you recommend? So to throw this out to you without, or great level design.
One of the best level design books I always recommend is 101 Things I Learned in Architecture School. It's a very common recommendation, but it's a yeah. Oh, here we go. It's on Mark's camera here.
I had to just. It was literally on my shelf behind me. It's a nice little pocket. It's bigger than a pocketbook, but yeah,
it's almost read on the loo size.
Yeah, exactly.
Just get in there and read some text, read some wonderful point, and think about it.
But the points like Rob said, that is a really good book because it's really bite sized. Like every page is like a tip, basically. But like they all can easily translate into level design, and naturally, it just helps you understand spaces better. That's at least what I find anyway. Like understanding architecture is obviously going to help you understand spaces. So from a building point of view, like I recommend that one, like hands down, like doing your 2D layouts or doing your blockouts. And I've just seen Mark pick up the other one that I was about to recommend. But that one, Level Design, Concept Theory and Practice. And it's a really good book because it does take you through the stages, like different stages of level design. So it talks you from pure conceptual point of view, but then takes you through kind of the theory behind it and how to put it into practice when levels. And it still holds up today. Like I'll still go back to it every now and then just to have a read through it. But I think I first came across it when I was in university and I like used it as part of my dissertation. But yeah, it goes through three specific stages. Like, so it tells you what you have available to you, how it works and what it works in.
There's one more that I don't actually have here because I have it by my bedside to read, which is one, it's called Level Up.
Yeah, I also have that one. That's really good.
Which goes through, it's been a while since I read it, but it really gives you an idea of the kind of hero's journey type stuff, but how it relates to games and how different mechanics actually can be made better for and more impactful. And it's not just level design, I think, but it's
overall design, really. Like the Level Up book's really good because it gives you this like kind of broad stroke approach, but also goes into the individuals like kind of segments, and it's done in a really kind of digestible way. I know it's got like a second edition now, which kind of accounts for some of the more modern trends, so like kind of web and stuff. Like it became a thing in mobile, which wasn't really a big thing in the industry when the first edition came out. But yeah, that's definitely like a go-to thing, like if you're just thinking about like design of games and kind of like player motivation and stuff like that.
Well, thank you. And on that note, I want to thank you both for being on this episode.
Thank you. Long may it continue.
Yes, it's always fun.
It's always fun. And we were just saying that we might do something special for Develop. Who knows?
That'd be good. Yeah, it's close to two of us anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
You'll be in Brighton, right?
Yeah, I'll be Brighton. So that's like 3 out of 3 so far. I'll see if anybody else that was on the panel will be down in Brighton. I'm sure. We can see if we can do something for that. But no promises. And on that note, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Night, guys.